Great. Thank you. Good morning to both attorneys. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're glad to see you today. We have three cases. This is the second of our cases scheduled for oral argument. We have two cases scheduled for non-oral conferences as well. This case is State versus Dwayne Holmes, A20-0899. And I'll just make a few notes before we begin with your arguments. We are having argument this morning over the Zoom platform, and we're recording these arguments, which will be available shortly on our website. No one else is permitted to make a recording of the argument. Counsel, you can assume that we have read your briefs and we are familiar with the facts of the case. Appellant will have 15 minutes to present argument. Respondent will then have 15 minutes to present argument, and then appellant will have a 5-minute rebuttal. Our timekeeper is also present with us this morning and will be keeping the time for each of your arguments. If there's any sort of technical difficulty that crops up during the arguments, we will stop the timer and wait until we have everybody arguing the case with us in the room, and then we'll get going again. Finally, I would just ask that before you begin your argument, you introduce yourself. With that, I will turn to attorney for the appellant. You may proceed with your arguments.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Andrew Nelson, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Dwayne Holmes. Today, I'd like to focus this court's attention on the first issue raised in appellant's brief, which is that this court must reverse appellant's conviction for felon in possession of a firearm because his conviction is the product of an unconstitutional seizure. In analyzing the seizure of Mr. Holmes' vehicle, there are three questions before this court. First, was Mr. Holmes seized? Second, when did that seizure occur? And third, did Sergeant Nitter articulate reasonable suspicion of criminal activity to justify that seizure? And today, the first two questions before this court can be answered rather quickly because the first issue, whether a seizure occurred, was essentially waived by the state when they failed to raise any substantive seizure argument in their brief. And on the second question, when the seizure occurred, based on clearly established case law by this court, including State v. Sanger, Illy versus Commissioner of Public Safety, and Klotz versus Commissioner of Public Safety, this court should find that a seizure occurred the moment Sergeant Nitter pulled into the single lane driveway behind appellant, blocked his exit, and boxed him in, because it was at that moment that any consensual aspects of this encounter evaporated. Here, the timing question is important. When the seizure occurred and determining that moment is important, because that's something the district court below got wrong. And the district court considered two of Sergeant Nitter's observations that occurred after he had boxed appellant in. That included the fact that appellant ducked down in his car and the fact that appellant's license plate didn't register to the single family home where he was parked. But because both of those observations occurred after the seizure, and because a stop must be justified at its inception, this court should not consider those factors. And without those facts, there wasn't reasonable suspicion for this stop. And that brings me to the third question before this court, whether there was reasonable suspicion for the stop. And appellant raises three separate arguments, three independent arguments that all lead this court to the same conclusion. This stop here was unconstitutional. The first of which is that evasive conduct by itself is no longer sufficient to support a traffic stop.
What's the basis for that assertion, counsel?
Your Honor, in State v. Johnson, the Minnesota Supreme Court held the opposite of what I'm asserting today. The state Supreme Court held that evasive conduct is a factor that may, by itself, be sufficient. But roughly 10 years later in Illinois v. Wardlow, the court seemingly changed that analysis. And there was a shift that this court recognized in a precedential decision, State v. Davis. And what this court recognized is that Wardlow held that evasive conduct is a factor that needs to be combined with other factors in order to amount to reasonable suspicion.
Does Wardlaw actually say evasive conduct alone can never be a basis for a stop?
It does not, Your Honor. The holding from Wardlaw merely states that evasive conduct is a pertinent factor that, when combined with other factors, can amount to reasonable suspicion for a stop.
But again, it doesn't say it must be combined with other factors.
It does not explicitly say that, Your Honor.
And isn't that the case that talks about headlong flight? That would be a circumstance in and of itself, which would give justification for a seizure, perhaps?
It does discuss headlong flight, Your Honor, but the court does not say that headlong flight would be enough. In fact, what the court does say is evasive conduct, even the consummate act of evasion, headlong flight, is a pertinent factor or a relevant factor.
But I'm just trying to get to the heart of it, because you're saying it's a pertinent factor, but you're not telling me there's a case that says, as it's holding, evasive conduct alone is not a basis for a Terry stop.
Your Honor, there is not a U.S. Supreme Court case, and there is not a Minnesota case, but there are circuit cases that assert that holding.
Understood.
But even setting aside that first argument that evasive conduct alone isn't enough, even if this court finds that evasive conduct is enough on its own to support a traffic stop, this court should find that the evasive conduct here was minimal, if existent at all. And the preliminary question here is whether evasive conduct was established. And this court shouldn't just assume that appellant's conduct was evasive. Evasive conduct requires evidence that somebody actually saw police and then tried to evade police.
What case do you rely on for that assertion that evasive conduct requires evidence that the person actually saw police and tried to evade the police?
Your Honor, I'm not relying on a specific case with that holding. I'm relying on the fact that cases by this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court generally establish evasive conduct through either eye contact or close proximity, and that there is a threshold issue because you can't run from something you don't see. And in the cases by this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court dealing with evasive conduct, eye contact is the primary way this court establishes evasive conduct. In Johnson, we had the trooper who was sitting in a highway crossover, and as Johnson drove by, they made eye contact, and then Johnson turned off the highway. And that eye contact allowed the trooper to reasonably assume that whatever Johnson did after the eye contact was in response to knowing police were there. I would also point to Petrick for this idea of close proximity, because in Petrick, we didn't have an officer's testimony that he made eye contact with the defendant, but we had the officer testifying that he drove past Petrick on a residential two-lane street. And then as soon as they passed each other, he performed a U-turn and began following behind Petrick. And under those circumstances, it would be reasonable to assume that Petrick saw the officer. But here, when we look at the record, we know that Sergeant Nitter was sitting in a dark parking lot of an abandoned business at 4:30 in the morning. And his police report, doesn't contain any information about where he was sitting in the parking lot. But as I argue in appellant's brief, it's reasonable to assume that if an officer is parked in an abandoned business's parking lot with the sole purpose of observing traffic, it's reasonable to assume that he would park his car in a way that people driving on that road wouldn't see him. And appellant's driving conduct itself, while it could support an inference that there was evasion, isn't a blatant evasive case. And what I mean by that is appellant here was driving on County Road I towards the parking lot. Appellant then slowed down, turned left, and drove north away from the parking lot, where he then performed a U-turn and drove towards Sergeant Nitter a second time, and then parked in a driveway closest to where Sergeant Nitter was parked. This wasn't a case where appellant pulled into a parking lot and then immediately whipped a U-turn when he saw Sergeant Nitter and then took off. This wasn't a case where Sergeant Nitter turned on his headlights or turned on his red and blue lights, or did anything to indicate that the appellant probably saw my car. And Sergeant Nitter's testimony reflects that. He says, I got the impression that he saw my squad car and was trying to avoid me. There was no certainty there. There was no even reasonable belief. It was just his impression. And so—
Mr. Nelson, assuming we agree with you that the U-turn itself doesn't indicate evasive conduct because he went past
and then turned around and came back towards him. And then, as I understand it, went past him, turned around, came back, went towards him. And then, but then immediately turned into a driveway and turned out the lights of the car and remained in the vehicle. Why isn't that subsequent conduct of immediately turning into a driveway, you know, at 4 a.m. and turning out the lights in the car, what's your best argument that that isn't sufficient to give a reasonable suspicion that Holmes was avoiding the officer or so saw the vehicle and was avoiding the officer?
Your Honor, pulling into the driveway and turning off the vehicle, while I would argue that is consistent with the activities of a law-abiding citizen, even remaining in your car is consistent with the activities of a law-abiding citizen. I would agree that that added fact, that is something that Sergeant Nitter could consider in establishing invasive conduct. But there are a lot of things that Sergeant Nitter could have done to increase that suspicion before seizing appellant. And what different cases by this court show is he could have parked in front of the house and not blocked the driveway and waited for a few more minutes to see how long appellant would sit in the driveway. He could have gotten out of his car, walked up the driveway, and knocked on the window with his flashlight and had a conversation with Mr. Holmes. This court has held that that wouldn't be a seizure. He even could have called the homeowner and asked, are you expecting any guests? And I do acknowledge that because of the 4:30 hour, that may not have been a viable option. But there are several other options Sergeant Nitter had. But I would also point this court to its decision in Davis and the unpublished decision cited by the State v. Boleyn. And in that case, in State v. Boleyn, the officer observed Boleyn leave a bar at 2:30 in the morning, or at 2 in the morning, get in her car, drive 11 miles an hour under the speed limit, repeatedly turn on and off her blinker, and then pull into a driveway that her car didn't register to. And this court found that not only was that not enough, but the officer didn't establish that Boleyn had ever seen his car. And under those facts, comparing those facts to this case, the evasive conduct here was slight. It was slight like the evasive conduct in Davis, getting out of a car and walking away from police. That's what I would equate this case to. The final argument that appellant raises deals with just the fundamental principle of reasonable suspicion analysis, and that is State v. Shrupp. And in State v. Shrupp, this court reversed the district court because the officer, even though he believed that the driver might be trying to avoid him, the officer didn't identify any inference of criminal activity. And what that case gets to is the initial U.S. Supreme Court cases, such as Terry and Florida v. Royer. And in Florida v. Royer, this court held that reasonable suspicion, or not this court, the U.S. Supreme Court, held that reasonable suspicion requires an officer to articulate that a crime has been or is going to be committed by the defendant. And the reason these evasive stop cases complicate that analysis is because, unlike speeding or blowing a stop sign, evasive conduct isn't criminal activity, but it can be suggestive of criminal activity. That's why Shrupp requires officers to articulate what this evasive conduct makes them suspect. And what the officer in Boleyn said is, I believe that Boleyn was driving drunk. She left a bar, she was driving slow, she was turning on and off her blinker. I believe that she was drunk and that's why she was trying to avoid me. And we don't have any inference of that here.
Mr. Nelson, I'm just gonna take you back to the seizure issue for a moment. So I know that your argument is that the seizure occurred when the officer Nitter parked his vehicle at the foot of the driveway. Does it impact our analysis in considering that whether there was a seizure, that the vehicle was turned off and the lights were off? In other words, there was a suggestion that the occupants weren't intending to back out of the driveway?
Your Honor, I would say that it doesn't. It doesn't complicate that analysis or change that analysis. This court has held that a driver who is asleep or a driver who's unconscious in their car can still be seized because it's an objective test that this court looks at. We look at as Michigan v. Chesternut said in the U.S. Supreme Court case, we look at whether the officer could determine if his conduct would be a seizure before it occurs, which means we take the driver's conduct completely out of the equation. The only thing that matters here in looking at this boxing in the driveway is whether appellant was able to drive his car out. That's what this court held in Illy, is that what matters in a boxing in is if the driver can drive away. And I would encourage this court to watch the squad car video. This was a single lane driveway, and there was no way for appellant to get out of that driveway as soon as Sergeant Ninter pulled into the driveway. Did that answer your question, Your Honor? I see that I'm running short on time, so I will conclude and just ask this court to reverse appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Nelson. And now we will hear from the attorney for respondent. Ms. Meyer, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Alexandra Meyer, and I represent respondent State of Minnesota. The question for this court is whether the officer had reasonable, articulable suspicion to investigate, or was he acting on a whim or a hunch? The key facts that Sergeant Ninter articulated in support of his decision to investigate the situation were the time, 4:18 in the morning, unusual driving conduct. He saw the vehicle slow. He saw it turn, immediately do a U-turn, and then rapidly drive away in the opposite direction. Now, this is not illegal, but it is unusual. It caught his attention. Next, he saw that this vehicle that had just rapidly driven down Edgewood Drive pulled into the first available driveway. This is the first available driveway directly past the officer, in addition. So where the officer is sitting, there is, this is the first exit.
Ms. Meyer, if the individual is trying to evade the officer, why turn into the first available driveway? Why is that indicative of evasive conduct?
It's indicative because not only does he turn in, he turns off all his lights so quickly that by the time the officer makes it these few feet down the road, the car is completely dark. No dome light, no headlights. He says all the lighting is off. So it is the combination of the first available driveway and the ghosting, the fact that the car is completely lightless. So those two factors together make that more significant. The fact that the passengers and the driver remain in the darkened vehicle, there's no lights on from the house, there's no indication that there's any movement at all, and that is unusual. And additionally, one factor that can be considered is that this is an experienced officer. This is a sergeant. This is not just a rookie. We don't know how long he's been a sergeant, but the very fact of him being in that position, he has some understanding of what's required for a traffic stop. Now, two of those.
Ms. Meyer, are you conceding that the boxing in, at its inception, amounted to a seizure? I just want to be clear about when you believe the seizure occurred.
I think there are some arguments about when exactly the seizure occurred, and with the limited record we have, it is difficult to determine exactly at what point the vehicle, the trooper's vehicle, the sergeant's vehicle blocked the appellant's vehicle in, because at the point that the squad video starts, he's already in that location. We don't know how long he is approaching it. We don't know if he's back enough feet that somebody could exit initially. We just start from the video starts from him being at the very front of the driveway. I don't think this court needs to reach that issue though, because the issue that dominates is whether there was reasonable articulable suspicion for whatever seizure might have occurred. And if you look at the two facts, the unusual driving conduct, immediately turning off the road, and then pulling to the front of the driveway, shutting off all the lights, that is enough for this experienced officer to have the impression, quote, that the vehicle had seen my squad car and was trying to avoid me. We're looking at what a reasonable, objective officer would believe under the circumstances. And under these facts, he had the impression, and he relayed that to two other officers, and we have their reports as well. So not only Sergeant Knitter's impression, but two other reasonable officers hearing this agree. Sergeant or Officer Asa wrote, "Sergeant Knitter advised that a vehicle just tried to ditch him." And we don't know the exact words that were conveyed, but that's what this officer understands. This vehicle was trying to ditch Sergeant Knitter. He stated the vehicle was suspicious with their driving and quickly pulled into an address. And then the second backup officer, Officer Lavoie, confirms this, saying Sergeant Knitter called out that he was investigating a vehicle that quickly turned into a driveway.
So it sounds like there's no question that he was able to articulate what his suspicion is. Would you agree then that our primary task is to evaluate the reasonableness of that suspicion?
I think that's accurate, Your Honor. I would respond briefly to what Mr. Nelson raised about, in his brief, he argues that if the appellant was trying to avoid the officer, he did it bizarrely. And here he again mentioned this in his remarks. But if you think about what an officer is looking for at 4 a.m., what are things that will catch their attention? It's signs of intoxicated drivers, for example, and a driver making not well-considered decisions, making unusual driving patterns. Those are things that fit within that category. Sorry, Judge Larkin, it looked like you were about to speak. So I don't think you can't judge how this driver drove as proof that he wasn't evading properly or wasn't getting away fast enough. The choices he made, for a reasonable, experienced officer looking at those choices, those factor into the determination of how reasonable a stop was. Additionally, the sergeant does not have to be sure about appellant's actions being a sign of criminal activity. There's never a way for an honest officer to be completely sure about a driver's motivations. What he can do is rely on his experience, on his understanding of the time, the place, the situation, the driving conduct, and he makes inferences. That's completely allowed under Terry and its progeny. Terry expects that there is innocent conduct that will be caught up in this kind of investigative stop. It's not whether there's a possibility of innocence, it's whether there's a possibility, a reasonable possibility of criminal activity.
Ms. Meyer, can you address Mr. Nelson's argument regarding the Shrupp case? Basically, he was arguing there isn't enough information here for the, or the officer didn't have enough information to infer a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, as I understand it.
So respondent's position is that Shrupp is significantly distinguishable. So in Shrupp, there's no indication that it was nighttime. I think nighttime is a very important factor here. It was 4:18 in the morning when appellant was driving past Sergeant Knitter. In Shrupp, the time of day isn't even mentioned because it doesn't matter. The officer in Shrupp saw a car drive by. The car was registered to a woman. It was a man driving. It's hard to imagine what possible suspicion could rise from that. But the officer continues watching and he sees this driver pull into a driveway, get out, talk to the person who lives there, get back in his car and drive away. That is significantly different from a situation like this where appellant drives into a driveway and doesn't get out at 4 a.m. So this is, if you look at all the evasion cases, they are so fact specific. Appellant mentioned the Boleyn case. In respondent's brief, we cited it for the fact that each one of these cases is so fact specific. And here, the facts that support the stop are the evasive conduct, which by itself is enough. But in addition, the time, the unusual driving conduct, the speeding up, slowing down, turning, U-turning. And then immediately, the very first opportunity, turning off of the residential road into a driveway and then shutting off all lights and pretending that nothing is there. Additionally, unlike some of these cases, like the unpublished Johnson decision, the officers, in the seizure is minimally invasive. It is the very most limited of interaction initially. The officer pulls into the driveway where he can see something illuminated by his headlights. At that moment, he can see no one's getting out of the car. No one's coming out of the house. There are no lights on. There's no dome light. There's no phone light. At that point, he has enough to turn on his spotlight and illuminate the vehicle. And once he does that, he can see that the occupants of the vehicle are laying back as if they're hiding. So at the very moment when he pulls into the driveway, he has enough to support any sort of seizure. And from that moment on, his suspicions are never dispelled. They only continue. And this is not a situation where the officer exits the car with guns drawn. He has his lights flashing. He's not handcuffing anybody and taking them to the ground immediately, unlike some of these other cases. For example, in the unpublished Johnson case, which I know, Judge Larkin, you were on that panel, I believe. In the Johnson case, the officers, it's 5:45 in the morning, and it's an alley in North Minneapolis, and a pedestrian is walking down the alley. The officers see him, see he's wearing dark clothing. He sees them and he turns and runs on foot. They chase him for two blocks, and then they find him and take him to the ground, handcuff him. The Johnson non-precedential decision, which is confusing because the main case we're talking about here is another Johnson case, but the 2018 Johnson case, this court found that that little amount of that evasive conduct was enough and stated that within the context of the chase, the tackling, the handcuffing, that the stop was fine, the seizure was fine. And if that all was appropriate here, the minimal invasive conduct of pulling into a driveway where this car has vanished is supported by all of these factors that Sergeant Nitter articulated. Illinois v. Wardlow requires reasonable suspicion determinations to be based on common sense judgments and inferences about human behavior. Here, an experienced officer made those judgments based on suspicious driving conduct, his experience, the time of day, evasive behavior, pulling into a driveway, shutting off all his lights. And that was sufficient for him to investigate further. Unless there are any further questions, I would ask that you affirm the district court.
Thanks, Ms. Meyer. Mr. Nelson, rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by first addressing the unpublished Johnson decision, which Judge Larkin authored. And one or two of the factual differences between Johnson in this case that I think are really important to point out is first, Johnson turned, looked at the police car, and then took off running. And that's that close proximity, that's that eye contact that allows the police to say, hey, he's running and he's running because he saw us. And we don't have that in this case. But the other thing I would like to point out is the extent of that evasion or how aggressive is the wrong word, but how fast this person ran away, what this person did. And in Johnson, after the Johnson looked at the police, he took off running and sprinting through people's backyards. And as Wardlow points out, there's a difference between evasion and headlong flight. And that difference is that evasion is consistent with the activities of a law-abiding citizen. It's consistent with going about your business. It can be suggestive of criminal activity, but it's also consistent. whereas headlong flight, seeing an officer and then running through a backyard, is the absolute opposite of going about your business. And so I would distinguish Johnson on those facts. I also think it's important to talk about Shrupp. And opposing counsel makes two reasonable inferences from the decision, but those inferences aren't explicitly stated in the opinion. And so in Shrupp, the officer was following directly behind Shrupp's vehicle. He observed that the driver was a man, the vehicle was registered to a woman, and then the car turned into a driveway so quickly, he thought the driver was trying to avoid him. And opposing counsel says that there's no evidence that this was at nighttime, and opposing counsel is correct, but there's no evidence it wasn't. And also, the opinion says nothing about Shrupp getting out of his vehicle and talking to the homeowner. The opinion says that Shrupp pulled into the driveway, the officer pulled over where he could see the vehicle, and he observed Shrupp speaking with the homeowner. And while it's reasonable to assume he got out of his car, it's also reasonable to assume that there was a homeowner in the front yard who he was talking to, or that the homeowner came out when Shrupp pulled into the driveway. And so we don't have any finding that Shrupp exited his vehicle and walked up to the front door of the house or anything like that. And so I would argue that Shrupp is not factually distinguishable from this case. The final thing I would like to bring to this court's attention is opposing counsel mentions Terry and how conduct that isn't overtly criminal can justify a stop. But in Terry, we dealt with an officer with, I believe, 18 years of experience who watched two men take turns walking to the front window of a store, walking back to the corner, conferring and repeating 12 times. And on those facts, the officer said, this conduct is so unusual. It's so strange that even if it is consistent with legal activity, it makes me think that they are casing this store for a robbery. And there's two really important points there. The first is how unusual is this conduct? And I would assert that Terry, which set out this exception, was significantly more unusual than appellant's driving conduct in this case. But the second thing, and this goes to Shrupp, is that the officer identified an inference of criminal activity. He said, based on my experience, this is what I saw. And based on what I saw, I think that they are going to commit this crime, or that they have committed this crime. And that's why I cited Shrupp in appellant's brief, because Sergeant Nitter believed that appellant was trying to avoid him, but avoiding an officer isn't a crime. And there are many reasons why a person, especially a Black person, would choose to avoid police that are inconsistent with criminal activity. And so, unless this court has any further questions, I'll just conclude by asking this court to reverse appellant's conviction for felon in possession of a firearm. Thank you.
I have one further question for you, Mr. Nelson. If we were to conclude that the published Johnson decision still applies in this context, what is your best argument that that there wasn't, that the conduct here doesn't meet the standard in Johnson?
Your Honor, I would point to two arguments. I apologize, I know you asked for one. I would ask this court to find that the evasive conduct here was slight and it wasn't established in the first place. And I would also ask this court to find that because Sergeant Nitter did not identify any inference of criminal activity, the stop can't be upheld. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both for your arguments this morning. This case was well briefed and well argued. The case is now submitted. We will be issuing our decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you.